From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with Police Lieutenant Lucy Duvall. She was one of the first women street cops in Cleveland and the first woman in the country to head a vice squad. Now she heads Cleveland's sex crimes unit. Also, growing up in the land of a dying dream, we talk with writer William Kittredge. He has a new memoir about growing up in the American West. And book critic John Leonard reviews Summer Meditations, a new book of essays by the former president of Czechoslovakia, Václav Havel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A Transworld Airways jet, Flight 843, bound for San Francisco, caught fire this afternoon when it skidded off the runway during takeoff from New York's Kennedy Airport. There were at least five minor injuries. NPR's Margo Adler reports from New York.
Rescue vehicles are still on the runway and Kennedy Airport is closed. All passengers have been successfully evacuated. While the exact number of passengers on the plane is unknown, the plane was full and an L-1011 generally holds about 300 people. The aircraft was departing the runway at about 5:45 p.m. when it veered to the side and burst into flames. Passengers were evacuated from the plane via emergency chutes. A Port Authority spokesman, Tom Middlemas, said the fire is still burning. It is miraculous, he said, that more people were not injured. I'm Margo Adler in New York.
The chiefs of the nation's armed services told a House subcommittee today that they're taking serious measures to combat sexual harassment within their ranks. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The chief of naval operations, Admiral Frank Kelso, said the Navy has known for years about sexual harassment. He called it a cultural and institutional problem in the Navy, precipitating a crisis of significant proportions. The admission followed yesterday's revelation that Pentagon investigators have obtained film of a 17-year-old girl being disrobed by Navy pilots during the so-called tailhook incident. Maryland Democrat Beverly Byron reacted to the disclosure.
I looked at that as a positive state because an aviator who has had those films for 10 months has finally gotten a streak of conscience and has given those films up.
All of the military chiefs condemned sexual harassment and detailed the steps they are taking to combat it, including education, training, and disciplinary action. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
A senior Russian official says there's evidence that Americans captured during World War II may still be living in the former Soviet Union. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
According to a front-page article in today's Izvestia newspaper, evidence exists in the archives of the KGB that some Americans who fell into the hands of the Red Army during World War II were thrown into Stalinist labor camps. Some of them, it is not known how many, may have survived. The article was written by General Dmitry Volkoganov, co-chairman of a joint Russian-American committee carrying out the search for possible American POWs here. During his summit meeting with President Bush in June, Russian President Boris Yeltsin said he believed some American POWs were still being held in Russia. But so far, no concrete evidence has been revealed to back up Yeltsin's claim. Until today, Volkoganov has discounted Yeltsin's remarks. However, Volkoganov has revealed no details about the alleged Americans still in Russia. He also provided no information about the possibility that American POWs from the Korean and Vietnam Wars may still be alive here. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 13 points to close at 3,391. This is NPR News. The Senate has approved a number of tax incentives designed to encourage Americans to conserve energy. The incentives include a measure that gives a bigger tax break to employers who buy their workers mass transit tickets while making it more expensive to offer them free parking. The tax incentives were added to a wide-ranging energy bill that was intended to be the domestic response to the Persian Gulf War. That bill has been inching its way through Congress for the past 18 months. A judge ruled today that a suspended Miami police officer awaiting retrial in a racially sensitive case will have at least some of his defense costs paid by public money. Doug Phillips reports from Miami.
More than 3 years of court hearings, a trial, and a successful appeal have left William Lozano broke, according to defense attorney Mark Seiden.
He's lost his house, he's lost his car, he's lost his personal possessions. He's driving around in a borrowed car.
Seiden persuaded Judge W. Thomas Spencer to declare Lozano indigent for the purpose of paying some defense costs, primarily expert witness fees. Lozano's attorneys are not being paid by the court. Lozano, who's Hispanic, faces a retrial for the 1989 shooting which killed two black men and led to 3 nights of rioting. He was convicted of manslaughter, but an appellate court reversed the Miami jury's decision, ruling that Lozano's trial shouldn't have been held in such a racially tense city. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Miami.
A Senate subcommittee voted today to provide the $2.25 billion that President Bush has requested this year for the controversial space station project. The vote came just a day after the House voted to trim the space station budget to $1.7 billion after defeating a move to cancel the project altogether. Opponents say the space station is siphoning off resources that are needed for domestic problems. Supporters of the project say it provides vital aerospace industry jobs and technological advances. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lieutenant Lucy Duvall, is a good example of how women's roles have changed in police forces around the country. She joined the Cleveland Police Department in 1973. While she was still a rookie, she started working undercover as a prostitute to bust Johns. 5 years later, she was a member of a special strike force focusing on street crime, fraud, and hostage negotiations. She later became the first woman in the country to head a vice squad. Now she heads a recently created sex crimes unit. There's a new book about her called Working Vice. I spoke to Lieutenant Duvall and asked her first about her early days on the force. She was in the first group of women in Cleveland allowed to go out on patrol. This was a result of a class action suit filed by members of the Women's Bureau. Lieutenant Duvall told me that when she joined the force, the police stations weren't prepared for women.
The one that I was assigned to did not have a ladies' room. They didn't have any type of separate locker facility. So, you know, those kind of things they absolutely not prepared for. They didn't have a really good female officer uniform, because the uniforms that the women had worn before that consisted of skirts and blazers, and which, you know, would not be appropriate for street work. And so they didn't have a supply of uniforms for us. I was out on the street for several weeks, maybe up to a couple of months, I don't recall exactly, before I actually got a uniform.
What were you wearing until then?
Just regular, slacks and a jacket. I was sort of like a, misfit, I guess.
Yeah, undercover when you weren't supposed to be undercover.
Yeah, that was sort of it. I was sort of this strange person that was wearing, kind of regular practical clothing with a badge on the front of it.
So what'd you do for a ladies' room if there wasn't one?
My partner, who incidentally works in the sex crime unit for me now, he would stand at the door of the men's room and say, off limits for a minute, Lucy's in there. And a lot of times I would go to one of the area hospitals that, of course, we spent quite a bit of time anyway, getting reports and things. So, and I would use the facilities there.
Did you get a lot of resistance from the men on the force when you joined?
It's strange. I went out to the district that was the highest crime rate in the city and was the largest district and had a reputation for having some of the problems in the police department. It was kind of a, dumping ground. And so I expected a lot of resentment. What I found was certainly some resentment. There was no question about that. And it's like any other male-dominated profession. You're never going to get everybody, to embrace that concept of women on the job. But there were really a number of officers out there, the younger ones, who were not quite that ingrained with the idea of not allowing women in basic patrol. And there were a number of them who, even if they didn't like the idea, were at least willing to accept it and not try to put more obstacles in my way. But there were some that were resentful.
Now, I understand that the wives group, a group of wives of officers, resisted having women on patrol.
Well, apparently they did. Now, of course, I was never part of the police auxiliary, and so I didn't attend any of their meetings. But there was certainly a faction of them that were just very concerned about what was going to happen, and that their marriages were going to be put in jeopardy, and that, you know, they were very concerned about what was going on in these zone cars, and now there were women out there. And, there was, absolutely some concern about that. I think, though, I don't recall anything really overt ever happening. And so I think some of it maybe was a little bit of hype as time went on, too. And it gradually that sort of just tapered off, I guess, when they found out that, you know, nothing drastic. It really happened.
Mm-hmm. What was the first really big test for you where you were in a confrontational situation, a violent situation?
Well, actually, I think one of the biggest tests for me didn't come from a situation of real violence. And maybe this speaks a little about, you know, what is frightening to different people. One of the first calls that we went on was to go into an abandoned funeral home after a man who allegedly had some mental problem and was carrying a shotgun. And I mean, it was scary in there. It was dark, and all the heavy draperies and everything. It was really, you know, frightening to me. And I thought, my gosh, this is just, you know, pretty bizarre. And so that was when I realized that this was the kind of thing I was going to be doing. That had an impact on me. As far as some of the early situations of violence, they almost happen so quickly that it's all in retrospect that you start thinking about them. So while they're going on, you're just doing what you've been trained to do, and then it's kind of afterwards you look at it and think, wow, I'm glad that turned out the way it did.
Well, what was the first violent situation for you? Because you didn't know until that point what your reflexes would be.
Right. I think one of the first probably, and I think this is recounted in the book, was with the in the schoolyard, where I this man who was intoxicated and made some moves, like he was trying to get close to me, and he made a grab at me, and I did exactly what I had been trained to do, which was just back him off with my nightstick. And we had been told and taught to, you know, if you put your nightstick right in someone's chest and give, you know, a push, and that you really don't need an awful lot of strength to get them off balance, and, you know, they'll kind of topple over. And that was exactly what happened. And it made me feel good that I, you know, remembered all this stuff and was able to do it when I needed to. And, you know, it worked out real well. And there was no question that some of the other officers that were there on the scene, you know, it sort of opened their eyes a little bit to say, well, you know, maybe this isn't, you know, as bad as we thought. You know, maybe she can do something. So that was probably the first one, when somebody actually, you know, made a grab at me. And I'm not very large, and I have short arms, and we were always told not to let people get within arm's length of you.
Mm-hmm. You know. Not very large. You're 5'3", aren't you?
Yes.
And you weigh about 100 pounds?
Well, I did, Terry. Okay. You know, the years have, but we don't really need to go in.
Anyways, I know that 5'3" is not very small. It's not very tall. It's pretty short. I imagine that a lot of people would look at you and think, "Well, she'd be easy to overwhelm. I could take her easily." So did criminals ever try to take advantage of you, figuring that they could like knock you down and get away pretty easily?
I don't think so, because what I tried to indicate, and which I think maybe was almost an advantage in ways, was that, you know, clearly I wasn't going to be able to fight it out with somebody, you know, and get into some, you know, fisticuffs type thing. And that's, you know, not really what, you know, we were trained that much to do anyway. And I think people quickly perceived that I obviously wasn't going to be able to do that, and that I might be forced to shoot them.
Right, which I guess is a pretty strong message.
You know, so they would leap to something, you know, far more serious than what I had in mind. But I think that was an advantage, because people would just say, "Hey, wait a minute, you know, she's not going to let me deck her or something, you know, she's going to pull that gun out and shoot me.
Did you ever have to use your gun?
I've never had to shoot anybody. No, I've certainly had it out and ready. And we're trained in certain situations to have your weapon ready should you need it, but I've never had to shoot anyone.
You went on the streets as a decoy prostitute when you were working in the Vice Squad before you became the head of it. What exactly did you have to do?
Well, basically, we sort of stood around and waited for a John, as they're referred to solicit us. And because, of course, legally, the decoy can't make the first move and can't initiate the conversation. Mm-hmm. It has to be clear that the John is doing the soliciting. So you sort of kind of stand around and wait for somebody to approach you, usually in their car. You know, they'll pull up beside you on, you know, on the sidewalk. And so, and let them take the lead in the conversation, and so that it's clear that they are, you know, soliciting for you for sex and that they are willing to pay a certain amount of money.
So did you ever get into a tight spot with a John who was soliciting you?
Yeah, I got into, you know, a few. One in particular was probably the one that turned out to be potentially what could have been the most dangerous, and had to start thinking about the tactics that we were using. And a man picked me up. He solicited me, and at the time we were having the decoys would get in the car with the John, and when we got in the car, that was the signal to our backup that was watching us that we had been, you know, solicited. And then the backup car would follow us down the street with the idea that then they would just pull us over, you know, just like a regular vice car, pull us over and, you know, arrest the male. Well, in this particular incident, the guy just didn't pull over, and the car got lost in traffic. I tried turning around in the seat, and I couldn't really see the backup car. And I kept suggesting to the guy, well, let's pull into this alley, you know, let's pull into this parking lot. And he just kept driving down, you know, one of the main thoroughfares in Cleveland, going out of the city. And the conversation that was evolving made it very clear to me that this was not some John. He was a pimp who had seen a new girl out on the stroll and, you know, was going to, you know, put her to work for him. And, you know, wasn't really interested in taking no for an answer. So he finally did pull in, and the backup, fortunately, when they came through traffic, they did see that we had pulled in, and we were able to get him under arrest. But after that, and that man, incidentally, had a long history of violence, and subsequently was the victim of a homicide on the street. He was killed by another pimp or something, so after that, we took a hard look at this idea of the policemen actually getting into the cars, you know, and we started making some changes. And then when, you know, later on, we just didn't do that at all because it wasn't safe.
Yeah, I could see. I could see that.
I began to see that real quick. I think this is not a good idea.
My guest is Lieutenant Lucy Duvall. She's the subject of a new book called Working Vice. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Lieutenant Lucy Duvall, and she now heads the Sex Crimes Unit in Cleveland for the police force. There's a new biography of her called Working Vice. Now, you founded the Sex Crimes Unit that you now head. Why did you feel like this unit was needed?
Well, the city council, our city council here in Cleveland, and the police chief, and I think primarily the chief at the time, felt that because of all the concern there was about child sexual abuse at the time, and, you know, and that we were looking very hard at you know, closely at some of these issues, that the department, you know, to keep current in the profession needed a specialized unit to handle these types of investigations and to handle the felony sex crimes committed against adults as well. And I had already acquired some background in child pornography. I had been working on those kinds of investigations and had some training in them. And he felt that I would be a good person to put in charge of that unit.
You've been involved in the investigations of serial rapists. Can you tell us briefly about one case and how the person was apprehended?
Sure. I can tell you about, you know, one of the I guess the more, they use the word famous, infamous ones in the city of Cleveland went on for the longest period of time. Man had been active in the west side of Cleveland and in some of the adjacent suburbs for several years prior to my even having the sex crime unit. And at that time, the district detective bureaus were handling those investigations and had realized that there appeared to be one man had been committing a number of crimes, up to about, you know, 30-some at that point, when he started a And soon after we started the sex crime unit, he, you know, started hitting again. And it was so frustrating because he kept hitting and hitting. And initially we had nothing. We had no clues at all. The victims were sketchy as to their descriptions. We were just at a brick wall. So one of the things that had been noted about him is that he did have some abnormality on his penis. And so we did start trying to zero in on that and trying to determine what that might be as a means of identification. And, you know, we went from there Then we went to the media. They were very helpful with the case. And as, unfortunately, we got a few more victims, we were able to put together a good composite drawing based on the recollections of several of the victims. And subsequently, finally learned who this man was. And once we got his name, we still didn't know where he was. He didn't have a permanent address anywhere. And our local NASA helped us enhance a bank photograph. This guy started getting a little careless, and he started grabbing bank cards from the victims, and then he would go, you know, to get fast cash. And one of the bank cameras took a picture of his car. It wasn't a very good picture, but the people at NASA said, you know, we went to them, and they said, we have wonderful equipment out here that we can enhance these photographs. They're the ones that we use to enhance the photographs that are taken by the space satellites. And so they did that, and we were able to see damage and stuff on the car that we couldn't have seen in the regular photograph. And one of the people up in our forensic lab, actually the superintendent up there, spotted the car. Just a, you know, great piece of luck, which all investigations need a little bit of luck along the way. And I sent some guys out to just wait for this guy to come back, and sure enough, he did, and we got him. But it was years. I mean, we are talking years of ongoing, just dogged investigative work, just bit by bit by bit of running down little bits of information.
But the risk of, what was the abnormality on his penis?
Well, it turned out that he had venereal warts, but initially it was none of the victims could describe it in ways, but they couldn't really liken it to anything. Some victims said it appeared to be a scar tissue. Some victims said it appeared to be a wart. So what we did as part of our investigative process is we got a drawing just of a penis, and we let the victims draw on it where it was placed and what to them it appeared like, and that gave us some help. When I started, I I talked to a couple of doctors about what it might be, and I found out that venereal warts can sort of come and go. They could be treated, and they disappear, and then they might come back. So we realized then that this might not be the great clue that initially it was thought to be, because we might not always have it.
Right. So did it help you?
Yeah, it did actually. Down by the time they get down to the trial, and they found out that in fact he had had venereal warts, and they had in fact come and gone at various times throughout this whole period that he had been raping. So it did tie in, and it made a wonderful, piece of evidence later on.
Do you miss being on the street?
I
don't mean as a decoy prostitute. Yeah,
no,
just as a as a police officer on the street.
Yeah, I do sometimes, but I'm kind of fortunate because in the position that I'm in now, I still go out on some investigations, and I enjoy doing that. Now I cannot take on an investigation and be the primary investigator because I can't get myself tied up in lengthy trials and stuff. I wouldn't get the rest of my work done. But I am able to go out on some investigations and do a little street work, and I do get still pretty actively involved in the child pornography investigations that we do. So, I keep that little outlet. So when I get that urge to, go out there and be a real policeman, I'm still able to do it.
Right.
Because I do enjoy
it. There's a bunch
of
photographs in the book about you working Vice. And in one of the photographs, you're opening up your locker, and inside the locker is a large a poster of a naked man from a Playgirl magazine.
Right.
Did you put that up in response to male officers having naked women in their lockers, or what?
Pretty much, and I did it really as a joke, because it was so funny, because there was no female locker room in this old district station, so they gave me a locker, but it had to be in the men's locker room. There wasn't any other place to put it, so there was an empty locker that they gave me to put my equipment and stuff in, so I didn't have to take everything I owned home with me every night. I normally just wore my uniform back and forth to work with a, coat or something over it, because there wasn't any place for me to really change clothes. But I did keep my equipment there, and the first day I walked into the locker room, I'd never walked into a men's locker room before. It was a little awkward. I just kind of stood at the door and said, I'm coming into the locker room. And I could see all these, similar things in the guys' lockers. And, mine really looked, no pun intended, naked in comparison. And so I thought it might ease the tension a little bit. And I grabbed one of these magazines. And actually, the first one I had was when Burt Reynolds was in Cosmopolitan. And I just tacked and just, taped it up in the door of my locker. And I said, I just kind of want my locker to look like everybody else's.
So what kind of reactions did you get?
They just laughed, and it did really kind of break the ice. And they saw that I wasn't coming in there as a feminist and a women's liber and, expect them to change everything to accommodate me, because that wasn't my intention, as I didn't think that was the way to, that would have just put another obstacle in my path, I think.
Lieutenant Lucy Duvall heads the sex crimes unit of the Cleveland Police Force. She's the subject of the new book, Working Vice. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the lure of the American West. We talk with writer William Kittredge about the subject he keeps returning to. He has a new memoir about growing up in the West called Hole in the Sky. And book critic John Leonard reviews Václav Havel's new book of essays, Summer Meditations, about what power does to the people who get it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A TWA jumbo jet went off the runway while taking off this evening from New York's Kennedy Airport and burst into flames. Officials say at least 15 people were injured of the some 300 on board. FAA spokesman Bob Fulton says the plane was on a flight from New York to San Francisco.
TWA flight 843, no, 1011, departing runway 13 right, veered to the side, ran off the runway and burst into flames. The passengers were being evacuated from chutes. This was not a crash per se. It just veered off the runway, veered to the side of the runway, and went off.
It took some 50 minutes to put out the fire, which officials say completely destroyed the rear of the plane. A federal appeals court has granted a 48-hour suspension of its day-old order, barring the Coast Guard from picking up Haitian refugees and returning them to Haiti. The Department of Justice requested the move, arguing that yesterday's decision would touch off a new and dangerous wave of Haitian immigration. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
Yesterday, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the Bush administration policy of intercepting Haitians on the high seas and returning them to Haiti without determining whether they were political refugees was illegal. They ordered the Coast Guard to refrain from such actions. The Justice Department asked the appeals court for a stay of the order. Late this afternoon, the appeals court granted a 48-hour stay to permit, it said, the orderly consideration of such further application for a stay as the United States may seek from the Supreme Court. Government lawyers at the same time filed a 32-page appeal with Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Thomas gave lawyers for the refugees until tomorrow afternoon to reply. At the moment, government policy is back in force. I'm Margot Adler in New York.
East German leader Erich Honecker has been ordered to remain in jail, Deidre Berger reports.
Erich Honecker was indicted on 49 counts of manslaughter in connection with the shooting deaths of defectors along the former inner German border. He was also charged with breach of office and the abuse of power. After the indictment, he was taken to a cell in the hospital ward of Moabit prison, where other former East German officials are being held. German officials say his trial will begin later this year. Honecker's lawyers allege the 79-year-old was forced with massive threats to leave the Chilean embassy in Moscow yesterday. Chile's Socialist Opposition Party demanded the government account for Honecker's removal from embassy grounds, where he fled for protection last December. Berlin prosecutors are investigating charges of forced child adoption against Honecker's wife, Margot, who was education minister in the former East Germany. Margot Honecker left Moscow today and is expected to join her daughter in Chile. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 13 points. This is NPR News. President Bush is campaigning in California after a stop today in Texas to give his support to a super collider project that is supported by Democratic hopeful Bill Clinton as well. Opponents have said the plan is too expensive, with benefits mainly in one state, Texas. Commenting today on disappointing reports about economic growth, Mr. Bush blamed Congress for making things worse, charging that Congress has dallied while too many Americans are out of work. A group of congressmen today released a list of names of convicted felons who had their gun ownership rights restored by the Bush administration and then went on to commit other crimes. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The list, which was received yesterday by National Public Radio, had been the subject of a tug of war between gun control advocates and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The BATF runs a little-known program that allows convicted felons, felons who have had their gun rights automatically revoked, to get those rights back. Democrats had suggested that some of the people who'd been rearmed by the federal government at taxpayers' expense and then gone on to commit other crimes could be used to illustrate what they say is the Bush administration's hypocrisy on gun issues. New York Democrat Charles Schumer and other lawmakers say they're hoping this miniature scandal will help them pass two bills. One would put an end to the BATF program restoring gun rights to convicted felons, and another would prohibit states from doing the same thing. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Vice presidential candidate Al Gore is charged that officials of the Bush administration ignore issues of importance to women. The Democratic vice presidential candidate charged at a Washington rally that George Bush and Dan Quayle use family values as political fodder. Gore once again questioned why the White House would oppose legislation requiring employers to give workers leave time during family emergencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. William Kittredge is from a pioneering family that helped change the American West, only to be changed by it. His family owned a huge ranch, which has been described as the family's blessing and curse. William Kittredge was the third and last generation to live on it. He doesn't own any land, but the changing American West has become the subject of his fiction and essays. His latest book is a memoir about growing up in the West called Hole in the Sky. He told me how his family first acquired their land in eastern Oregon.
My grandfather got, in 1911, he got around 4,000 acres, I think, at the northern end of Summer Lake. In 1916, he began to amass what eventually added up to about 16,000 acres on the Klamath Marsh. And then in the mid-1930s, during the Great Depression, he picked up essentially no money down and a handshake almost, pay me later when you see me, the MC Ranch in Warner Valley, which was about 21 or 22,000 acres of irrigated land and a huge BLM allotment, around 1 million acres. Sometimes I think in the early days it was larger than that, about a million a quarter, I think. In any event, it was a huge property, and 50 miles from one end to the other that the MC was, and we had other properties in California and so forth. My grandfather really believed that somehow he was putting together an empire in a way that would last forever. I think it actually lasted about 9 years after his death. I think he thought the family would hold this together forever. And we, of course, didn't.
When did he die?
1958.
And why didn't the family hold it together?
Well, it was a matter of the ways in which power passed along, kind of aspirations in the family, the things my grandfather wanted. He really believed that everybody in the family should put money first, put property first, put the welfare of the property first. Put the money-making power of the property first, before happiness, before your marriage, before the prospects for your children, before whatever. That those things came first, and a great many people, in various kinds of situations, decided they didn't want to do that. And every time they didn't, he was furious and felt like they had betrayed him. Eventually, that kind of thinking, in which essentially. Love takes the hind seat, family takes the hind seat in a way, led to all kinds of hate and discontent inside the family, and made any kind of coherent feeling of togetherness in the family absolutely impossible.
What was your father's attitude toward the land that your grandfather brought? I'm sure your father was expected to be somebody who took as good care of it as your grandfather did, and who passed it on to you, the next generation.
He didn't want to go back to the land. Essentially, he got out of college, Oregon State College, in the 20s, and he wanted to go off and be a lawyer. He had all kinds of other aspirations. My grandfather spent all one day talking him into coming home, staying home, taking care of the property, being on the property. you know, doing what the oldest son should do, the only son should do. And my father, you know, was won over. He did it. And I think he regretted it all his life, and eventually that led to great trouble between the two of them. He was supposed to come home and be the proper heir, you know, the one who built on the beginnings my grandfather had made, the one who put it all together. And for a while he did that. When we got the property in Warner in 1935, 1936, 1937, and through the 40s, he managed the farming in Warner Valley and in very innovative ways. He drained about 8,000 or 9,000 acres of swampland, farmed it, put it into alfalfa. He was a remarkable leader, a remarkable innovator in that time. But all the time, he was always harboring this resentment that he had not actually wanted to do this. And eventually, and doing things, he made some good money in the process for a few years there, and he spent it in rather frivolous ways. As my mother said, he was ahead of his time in finding ways to spend his money. And my grandfather resented that. He resented the fact that my father knew movie actors and bought racehorses, all that kind of crazy stuff that my father loved to do. My grandfather thought was just insane. All that should be plowed back into the property. And my father didn't do it, in part, I think, out of resentment for my grandfather, out of resentment for the fact that his life had been, in a sense, he'd been talked out of his life, in a sense, which was, you know, his own fault. He should have allowed that to happen to himself. My father shouldn't.
Now, what about you? What was it like growing up and thinking of this huge expanse of land as being yours or your family's?
It wasn't something that ever really much occurred to you. I mean, it occurred to you. You knew how you were fortunate in a way. You knew that the few other people you knew, there weren't many other people out in that country, some families, probably 20, 30 families. You knew they didn't have it. They had their own ranches. They were smaller. You felt somehow, without ever knowing why, that you were entitled to it. I'm talking about when I was a child, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. But we went to the same schools with those kids, and you know, we played games with them. We didn't feel any different from them. And one of the codes in my family was that we better not act like we were any different or any, you know, somehow more privileged than those kids were. There were no privileges in the sense in my family. I mean, nobody had fancy cars until my father kind of rebelled against all that stuff. But essentially, everybody lived common, lived plain, and did what my grandfather said, which was put things back into the property. So we felt somehow that for a long time, believing what my grandfather said, that somehow this was proper. We had earned this. We were humble people. We were good people. We were doing God's work. We were making the world right. We were creating order in the world. And I think so many people in the American West believe that in one way or another to this day. And that accounts for in fact a lot of the anger and a lot of sense of betrayal that's everywhere in the West today, as we see some of the traditional businesses, some of the traditional ways of making a living pass out of being or really pass into hard times, like agriculture and logging and mining.
Do you think the people who believe that were right in believing it?
it's a dream of America. It's a dream. You know, people came here. America was possibility. America was you know, the kind of brave new world. And at the same time, America was wilderness. And America, it seemed to them, it was wilderness. It's astonishing that you know, the white folks from Europe came to a continent which had been populated, you know, essentially forever by people who didn't ruin it, and came here and looked at it and assumed it was wilderness. You know, they called it wilderness. It was some terrible, frightening place, and it had to be controlled. It had to be brought to order. It had to be, brought into some kind of alignment that people could understand as orderly. So we did just what my family did. We built fences. We dug ditches. We ordered the watersheds. We plowed. We did all that stuff. We created croplands. Those croplands were essentially planted into one kind of monoculture or another. We got rid of natural diversity. We killed off the coyotes. We killed all kinds of animals. Just got rid of them, you know. All that has been devastating to the continent. It's been devastating to our culture. It's very devastating to people in the American West now who are, as the impetus of that stuff begins to be looked at very closely and criticized a lot. They feel that somehow we're betraying them. That we're the great dream that they believed in of creating order in the world, which is what we thought we were doing, somehow turns out to not be the right idea, somehow turns out to be a bad idea.
William Kittredge is my guest. He's written a new memoir called Hole in the Sky. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is writer William Kittredge. His new book is a memoir called Hole in the Sky. How many times did you leave and return to the ranch before leaving it for good?
Well,
did you do that a lot?
Oh, yeah, various times. Never with the idea of actually leaving forever. I went away to college, and about my junior year at Oregon State, I discovered books and ideas and kind of fell in love with them. And I took class from Bernard Malamud, and, you know, he hooked me on the idea that maybe I'd someday be a writer. And so I always walked, and then I went in the Air Force, and I tried to write while I was in the Air Force. Actually tried to publish two or three things. I think they were laughably bad. Went back to the ranch after I got out of the Air Force. I was 24, 25, and went back to work, doing what I was supposed to do in a sense. Entirely too either dim-witted or afraid of the world, one or the other, to go out and try it as try to learn how to be a writer. Try to learn how to do all these things I had somehow been caught up with, you know, the notions of, and stayed on the ranch for 10 years. And finally, in 1967, when family dismay and upset and unrest finally came to a head, and we managed to sell the ranch, I went back to Iowa into the Iowa Writers' Workshop and got an MFA and decided I'd make a life for myself as a writer. My father supported me in that enormously. He all the way, I'm sure it sounded very crazy to him, but he said, I don't blame you. I spent all my life doing things I hated, and I sure wouldn't recommend that.
You know, it strikes me, although you don't have the land, you don't own the land the way your grandfather did, but the land is yours as a writer. You write about the land. I mean, you have it, but you have it in a different way.
I think so. You know, I think that you don't need to have physical ownership of a lot of things in the world if you have some kind of emotional connection to them. I always say, you know, in a way you have a kind of emotional ownership. I go back to Warner Valley every year or two, sometimes a couple of times a year. It's fine. I look at it. People have taken care of it. It looks good to me. They're doing the best they can. There are a lot of practices that I'd like to see stopped now as time goes by. But on the other hand, it's not being devastated in any particular kind of way. And out on the high deserts, the part that I really love the most anymore, I suppose, everything is it's very timeless out there, and it's very much the way things have been. And I don't need to own that.
So when your family did sell out in the 60s, did you get a lot of money from that?
We got quite a bit, yes. I think it was, my share, which wasn't a big share, was about $350,000, some of which I had committed to various foolishnesses before I ever got it, and then I got a divorce at almost exactly the same time and split the money and managed to go through every bit that I had in short order. I don't know why I did that psychically. Perhaps I don't know. It was just like a sense of freedom. I'd made my getaway, and now I suddenly had some spending money for a little while. And the only thing I did with it was of any use to anybody was I had the wit to get myself through the MFA program at Iowa and get myself a job at Montana before I really ran out of spending money. I got rid of it pretty fast, and I'm happy to say right now that anything I've got at the moment, I think I earned for myself.
Did you want to sever your ties in a way to the kind of Western aristocracy that your family had come to represent?
Yeah, I think probably that's so. I don't think I really had that in the front of my mind, but I think I certainly ran as fast as I could go, and I got rid of the money, and I felt like I cleaned up my act in some kind of way, and I found an entirely different kind of friends, and I've never gone back. I travel to Eastern Oregon now, and I always get up early in the morning, and I go down a little cafes and little towns, Burns and Lakeview and places like that, and sit in there at 6 o'clock in the morning and have some bacon and eggs and And it fills up with men that I might have been. And I look at those men and I watch them and I think, well, this is what I could have been. There's the man I could have been. And I don't feel any great sense of triumph or something that I didn't become that man. I'm glad that I'm not, in a sense. I'm glad I don't live out there anymore. And you know, there are lots of things about it that I didn't like. It was, you know, it was boring in lots of times. But on the other hand, I guess the thing that I really feel is that I have changed my life completely, and I'm happy that I'm not that person. But I always wonder, in a quite profound way, I think, what I missed by not being that person.
Yeah, I want to get back to something you were saying before. You were saying that you realized you didn't have to own property mm-hmm. to love it and to appreciate it. But there's times I know I've passed through a really beautiful place that had a really big sign on it saying private property, keep off.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you have a sense of, you know, that all beauty is not accessible to you. How frustrated are you when you come across land like that?
Well, I'm frustrated by that. When I say that you don't have to own property for it to be, you know, be part of you and so forth, it really helps if everybody else would play the game the same way.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
And of course they don't. And I think that one of the things, one of the kinds of contracts we're going to have to enter into more and more in the American West is that in some way there's going to have to be public, you know, public properties that are going to have to not be sold and not be fenced off for the, you know, exclusive use of a few apparently wealthy people. And it is very frustrating it's happening all over the West. It's a great cause of rage and discouragement in working class communities in the American West, for instance, in various areas in Montana, where the best land has been brought up and essentially fenced off and is no longer available to them. The working class people, the people who can't afford to buy land like that, are profoundly angered by that and profoundly upset by it. And it's the sort of thing you'll hear talked about over and over again in the barbershop, for instance. Those are issues that really touch people at the heart.
You don't own any land now. Do you own your house?
No, square inch.
No, I live in an apartment. Do you own that?
I live in an apartment in Missoula, which is just fine with me. Of course, I cheat, I guess, in a sense. For a long time, I've lived with a woman named Onyx Smith who owns 160 acres about 30 miles out of Missoula, and I go out there 3 or 4 days of the week, and it's beautiful property, and enjoy hers, so I'm probably cheating a little bit, too.
That does sound like you're cheating.
Not very much, no.
You kind of have the best of both worlds, no responsibility to the property, but you've got land to go to.
Yeah, I feel that way, so that's why I say I'm cheating a little bit.
William Kittredge, he's the author of the new memoir, Hole in the Sky. He lives in Missoula, Montana. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We have lots of news tonight, but also a summertime ghost story. This takes place in an old house in the Tanglewood Music Festival. There reputedly is a ghost, possibly a small child ghost, turning on faucets, opening doors, playing with a person's hair. We have an eyewitness account and some third-hand stories. Also, trouble in the Northern California wine fields with an insect that's eating the roots of the grapevines. Thousands of acres of vines could be destroyed. The replanting necessary may not be completed until after the turn of the century. And also, we'll talk with two members of the 1972 American basketball team that lost to the Soviet Union.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last summer, when he was still president of Czechoslovakia, Václav Havel wrote a series of essays about his job and country. Those essays are collected in his new book, Summer Meditations. John Leonard has a review.
There was a headline not long ago in the New York Times that told us, "Street crime hits Prague daily life." Nothing really surprising there. But the subhead to that story was indeed remarkable. Czech capital discovers one drawback of democracy. Democracy. Not, mind you, rampant inflation, staggering unemployment, runaway greed, corrupt politicians, or anything else to do with their new free market tinker toy economy. It's because Czechs can now vote that Japanese tourists and Vietnamese guest workers are no longer safe on the Baroque streets of the capital of Kafka, and neo-Nazi skinheads are bashing gypsies. It's because their speech is at last free that Czechs cry for lustration, a purge of anybody who ever had a cup of coffee or a Pilsner with a party apparatchik in the bad old days before Frank Zappa. It's because of self-determination that Slovaks are suddenly licensed to hate Czechs, and they all decided they no longer needed their playwright President Woodsprite, no matter what he says in these summer meditations on matters of principle and statecraft. What began as Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band has ended up sounding like another, sadder Beatles song, Nowhere Man. I yield to no one in my hero worship of Václav Havel. I've reviewed his books here and his plays elsewhere. I went to Prague 2 summers ago as if to Plato's Republic. I sought out the Magic Lantern Theater to steal some heat from the very idea of a revolution that was nonviolent, joyful, and funny. How can you not love a man who said in his first speech as president, "I assume you did not propose me for this office so that I, too, would lie to you"? But the job's worn him down. His prose in these meditations is flat and cautious, leached of irony. He knows perfectly well that tough love free marketeering has been turned before his weary eyes into yet another ideology, indifferent to children and the elderly and the infirm and the unlucky. He knows that even though planning is now a dirty word, there must be firm state policies on education and the environment, on energy and agriculture and foreign relations. He knows that an independent Slovakia will result in 2 weak nations at the mercy of self-aggrandizing neighbors. He also knows that his notion of a civil society is all but drowning in a tide of petty party politics, rabid nationalism, fast-buck opportunism, and soft porn. Yet he tiptoes around these subjects, naming no names, passing out more bouquets than brickbats, worrying recondite constitutional questions, avoiding any mention at all of the lustration that tears his republic apart. He speaks a distressing officialese. There are no jokes. Maybe if he'd named names and knocked heads, he'd still be president and there'd still be a Czechoslovakia. Maybe that's why nobody in the 3 separate parliaments wanted a popular election for the presidency or a popular referendum on the Federation. Maybe he'll be happier writing plays. They'd certainly be more fun to read than summer meditations. I haven't felt this depressed since they killed Bambi's mother. And I have a suggestion. Now that Ross Perot has folded his checkbook and gone home, why don't we invite Havel to run for president of the United States of us? I realize he wasn't born here, and so we'd have to amend the Constitution, which would also open the door to Henry Kissinger. But I'm almost willing to take that dangerous chance. We haven't had a decent writer in the White House, our castle, since Abraham Lincoln.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Summer Meditations by Václav Havel. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Vablaitis, Ron Barron, Bob Alls, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Allison Anders, director of the new film Gas, Food, Lodging. It's the semi-autobiographical story of a single mother and her 2 teenage daughters living in a trailer. They're barely getting by and they're not getting along. Also, the frustrations of an advocate for the homeless who went to work for a big city administration. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.